Okay, we are back on. Yes.
Okay, I'm back on. You can tell. Okay. When we look at the chronology of things, I guess we have to consider ourselves exceedingly lucky that in spite of the tragedy, and perhaps in part of the tragedy of what happened in Cordoba, the social conditions at the turn of the century, with the canneries in particular, and the nature of the town, which is, I think, is one of the highest per capita alcohol consumption towns in even Alaska, which is saying a lot, that the exploitation or destruction of the Yak people and the assimilation to Tlingit, how those two things timed out and left such as the speakers that I was able to work with is exceedingly fortunate. And I hope that posterity will not judge me too harshly in having missed too much. It would have been helpful if I had been able, especially in the 60s when there was a lot of resource, to, I mean, in terms of EX speakers and memory, that I could have spent more time with it instead of having to fulfill university priorities. But even with all of that, just that I happened to be here and have the time that I did with what was left of EAC then, where I feel very privileged myself to have been the one to get to do it. And I kind of wish that, you know, others were working on it too, and others have made some contributions, like in particular Jeff Lear, but who continually keeps asking questions about EAC that no longer can be answered, or wishing that we had, back in the 60s, the kind of documentation of the related languages in Athabaskan, and most especially Copper River Athabaskan, but any other Alaskan Athabaskan, and, because I certainly did also do my job in trying to elicit EAC cognates off of Athabaskan lists. I did that with what was available in the 1960s, with some productivity. Athabaskan languages can generally find 60% maybe cognates for what's in any other Athabaskan language in a given Athabaskan language. So you take Navajo and Otna Copper, for example, and you come up with maybe about 60% cognates. Still, that's not so bad. Naturally, if you take, you know, closer within the dialects, you get into the 90%. But
What is cognates?
Words from the same source.
Okay.
Proto source. So, for example, Greek ptero and so on, English feather. Pater, pizza, what is it?
What is it?
Father.
Father, yeah.
Pater, English father, the same rules, and Greek, penda, five, English five, and so on. Those are cognates, okay? In the case of Athabascan languages, we can find maybe about 60% cognates. So if you had a Navajo word list and you worked off that to get what words there are or not, then you might get two-thirds of the Otno vocabulary that way. But with EAC, it jumps down to about 30% across the board. So the EAC is no closer to Otna than it is to Navajo. They're all down in the 30%. Right. So maybe one third, but if we had the Otna dictionary we have now, back in the 1960s, it's possible that I would have listed dozens of EAC words that otherwise would never have been jogged out of memory, out of any living memory. But I certainly did go over the available stem lists and word lists that were available for Athabascan in the 60s. This can't compare with what we've got now, but and I've gotten, you know, some more, maybe 10% more or something like that. But I have a feeling that we're well up into the 90s of, or into the 90s percent of what had been left in living memory as of the 1960s, and which when I did the greater part of that work, or most of the work. And so, I mean, that's a, you know, look back at it. I have some other statistics. For example, when I made a complete what's the word? You have them for the Bible, list of all the words in the Bible and all of their occurrence, what do you call it? A concordance. I made a complete concordance of the EAC texts that we have, that we had of as of about 1969, and kept track of how many new words appeared per page. And of course, the first page was almost all new words, and the 100th page still several, but by the 500th page, maybe you'd only run across a new word every 10 pages. And put together for a number of points along the list of pages, how much new per page produces a curve, which flattens out at the top. And the name of that kind of curve is a what? There is a, I forgot the name of it. If you add one fourth to a half, 1/8 to that, 1/16 to that, 1/32 to that, you'll never reach, until you've gone an infinite number of times, one. Hmm. And that's the hmm of that curve. I forgot the word. S-Y-N something, whatever. Greeks in...
Not even in Greek.
Well, it's a mathematical term for a kind of curve, which, if you carry it out to infinity, it will end up at a certain number.
Right.
What the hell is that kind of curve called? Anyway, I then took that to a guy with computers from the 1960s, and he found out that that key number from that curve. If I had a billion pages of text, or at the rate they were coming, that I would have found within them 85 billion pages of text or something, that I would end up with the number 886.2 or something like that, different stems. In fact, I already had 1,100 stems because I had been very systematically and deliberately asking, what do you call this side of your nose, and the bridge of your nose, and the thing between your nostrils, and the thing under the, between your nostrils and your lip, and so on. And in a very detailed possible way to get vocabulary. And in terms of stems, I already had far more than the end point of that curve, because I had not just sat around waiting for somebody to speak the word, but asking for it. So, I mean, with little hints of this kind and that, I feel that EEC is fairly well documented. There's something to be said also for, it's true, we don't have much text in the language, and it's almost all from Annie Nelson Harry, and it's almost all kind of, her kind of traditional text, albeit unmercifully innovative in certain very dramatic ways. That are directly comparable with what we have in her, albeit in Galusha's English translation from 1933 in the 1938 book. Often we have the very same stories told so differently because of her maturity and because of, and I may not have gotten much around to this in the introduction to the book, because of the fact that she's not only more mature, instead of her late 20s and in 1930s, 33, but in her 60s and 1960s, she, not only the maturity of her perspective, but from her particular history, having witnessed the demise of her own people and its virtually total disappearance, that she was telling me these stories to me sort of totally out of their normal folkloristic context, as well as having gone through this dramatic historically dramatic life, and all of the controls which keep traditional storytellers to a standard of, a certain standard of discipline in following the story, she was utterly liberated, released from all those bonds of tradition, being the last one who knew the stories or could tell them in any way, mm-hmm. telling them to me, representative of a totally different culture of the future. In other words, telling them not to her own people, but telling them on behalf of her people to the rest of the world, to the ages, and not to potential critics, you know, elders who would shake their heads at the way she was doing things, which they certainly wouldn't be doing. As we could directly see in some of the stories, by the way, it was told in 1933 and the way it was told in 1965. The difference is extremely dramatic, and particularly in the departures she takes from the original. And the two stories that I keep coming back to are the very first two on greatness and smallness, or whatever you want to call it, the relativity of everything. And the EX think the Tlingits are big, or the Tlingits think they're big compared to the EX. Imagine what the Anglo invasion thought of Tlingit, or dealt with it with dispatch. And so the Tlingits' turn was coming too. And she could see this and puts it together in two separate events, two separate occasions. One is a story of that is based on traditional historic account of conflict with the so-called Aleuts. And that is the Chugach. But one comes from probably that, the Aleuts, and it's the story of the hunter who is out hunting bears and looks down and by this puddle notices very tiny people, probably 6 inches or so tall, just about the same size as Swiss Lilliputians, who were very busily hauling ashore a mouse hindquarter. And there were two mice. One was a black bear for them, and the other was a brown bear for them. And she takes delight in using the word shuntias, or shuntias kalachatas, I've forgotten which, but she takes delight in that. It means mouse thigh. And she uses that just as a common word, you know, a mouse rack. I've forgotten which, but here they were wrestling with this mouse thigh. And it took four of them or something to pull it ashore and all that. And it's quite a prize, and the women are there. And but he bemusedly picks up one of them. And the poor little fellow realizes, you know, he's been picked up in the air by this monster man mountain or whatever, and bribes him with his strawberry leaf weapons to let him go, and he scoots back to his own people, and tells him, quick, we got to get away from this this monster is after us. And but the monster, that is the hunter who was too busy hunting bear, paid them no heed and just, you know, left the puddle and mm-hmm. went on, because he was busy doing something of significance, like hunting bears. And that's story number one. And then story number two is, interestingly enough, a distortion of likewise, because in the Eskimo original, in the 1933 version of that first story, a lot of it has to do with the personalities of each one of these, of the little people and their internal politics, and you know, the big enders and little enders or whatever they were, and treats them as creatures of consequence, which they certainly were in the folklore, as that you have to be nice to these spirits represented by the lake dwarves, or you'll have bad luck hunting and so on. so it was an important part of the culture. But here she treats it just exactly like the Swift treats the Lilliputians.
Yeah.
But the very next story, the next story in the book, is about the rat skin, the giant rat, which reputedly had its home in some monster cliff somewhere between Yakutat and Cordova. And there's this family traveling along by canoe between the two places. And the wife stupidly and carelessly says, gee, it'd be interesting to see that rat. And the husband says, shut up, my God. You could come out anytime. And sure enough, this monster rat comes out and from its hole, it's just an opening at the top, on the top of the cliff, and an opening at the bottom of the water. And naturally, it upsets the canoe, and I think the wife is lost, drowned, and the guy manages to save himself by clinging to the fur of this monster rat. Its hair was as long as the hair of a black bear skin. And he goes with it to its cave, or hangs onto it till he goes back in its cave, and sort of keeps him there as a pet, and cooks food for him by sitting on the food, and this and that, and but he's plotting ways to get out of there, and he discovers a root hanging from the ceiling, and he manages somehow to climb up through the hole and escape back to his own people.
Right.
And they all want to get this rat. And they go over to the top of the hole at the top, and dump some ravens down the hole, which agitates the rat, so it sticks its flails its tail around, and sticks its tail, goes up through the hole. And they manage heroically to chop off the end of the tail, and the giant rat evidently must bleed to death. And there's no way that they could possibly have hauled it ashore, except that a big tide came and washed it ashore like it would a whale. And with that, they managed to butcher this rat and take its skin. And inside the rat's stomach are the bones of so many important chiefs and men that it had made meals of in its day, and so on.
Right.
And but they heroically managed to slaughter the rat and to get its skin. And the skin of this rat, although it's true that the hair was falling out in places and all, was a great prize. So much so that the repute of this reached far and wide, and foreign tribes from as far away. There's like people in Juneau. They're like us, but they're different, you know. But they're just like people in Juneau. They came and made war on people just to get this rat skin. What the hell good is a rat skin? Well, they made war about it. And the end of the story, instead of the traditional, is that I think she deliberately played with the grammar, which is not rich in just differentiating one third person from another. So they, the people who wrested the rat skin from them, or from whom the rat skin had been wrested or something, killed them. They slaughtered them, and they just died, slaughtered them, killed them all off, and there were none left. But you can't tell by the grammar which side slaughtered which side. And I think she's being quite deliberate about this because it obviously doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, whether the Russians got us first with the bombs or we got them with the bombs, there'd be nobody left anyhow. And I mean, that's the kind of thing that was surely on her mind. And I said, well, people going to war over a rat skin, for what the hell, what reason? And so they slaughtered them all, and there were none left, of whom it doesn't matter. And she tells the thing with a kind of a smirk or a laugh at the end. And she has every right to laugh at that because of the philosophical triumph that she has actually accomplished in the way that she has completely, I wouldn't say distorted, but completely revised the meaning of these stories to a much even deeper philosophical perspective and truth than there's a level of Swift because she's an EAC. Mm-hmm. And so that's just the first two, and there are many others that are several of them paired like that. I think I'm going to let.
It's what you are saying now. So she's using the story.
Yeah, she is just using these stories and not telling them, but she's using them as raw material for a still higher art that transcends anything traditional because nothing traditional is left. So she's soaring into the ages and no bond, terrestrial bonds left.
Exactly what you like in people, I think.
Yeah. So she is the spirit of a people that is, well, thank God it's not lost in every respect, and I feel very lucky to have been privileged to know someone like that and play a role that I can still play.
Right. So you think this concludes our discussion of EAC?
Well, there's all kinds of linguistics I could go into and so on. It's fascinating how EAC explains so much of the particular nature of Athabascan, in a sense, that it's as though, going back to the beginning of this little discussion, that there was a language known as Proto-Athabascan-EAC, which is ancestral to both Athabascan and EAC. Mm-hmm. And EAC branched off, now represented by one person altogether, and Athabascan branched off, now represented by 30 languages and over 100,000 speakers of them, mostly Navajo. But it's as though you had something happen in a room with two windows on opposite sides of the room, and you had 100 people looking in one window and telling you together a story that you can reconstruct from the 100 people looking in that one window. You can reconstruct some kind of truth from that. And then you've got one person looking in the window on the opposite side and telling you what happened. And that one person's testimony, I mean, if you were a jury as to what happened in that room, should you not give as much attention to that one person as you do to the 100 looking in the other window? as to, you know, who was holding the knife in which direction and which way the moves took place and so on, that IAC tells you as much in its own way as all the Athabaskan languages put together. In certain other ways, it tells you even more, because IAC is extremely conservative in the way it allows you to put sounds, including sequences of consonants, consonant clusters, together. Let's say the Navajo verb stem to tickle is rr, and the IAC is ha-ch, or rather ha-ch, but it can be ha-ch or ha-ch, depending on whether you tickle in one place or tickle repeatedly in one place or tickle around here and there and so on, and other things can be ha-ch. If you do it customarily and so on, whereas Navajo is either chayr or maybe chayr alternating with chosh in various unpredictable and difficult ways. But the IAC explains, because it allows because IAC allows sequences of consonants, consonant clusters, without restriction, which in Athabaskan gets streamlined pronunciation-wise into complex patterns that don't have any obvious explanation, unless you take IAC into account. So the IAC explains a lot of the earlier stages of Athabaskan in some respects. Just to take, you know, that one little example, there's many other ways in which IAC is much more conservative sound-wise that way. It allows, say, for thorny sequences of consonants, where Athabaskan requires things to be relatively streamlined, or extremely streamlined in some cases, like losing all of the final consonants altogether. So tickle might come out as oh, or something with nothing at the end. And IAC allows, you know, three or four or five consonants strung together. So it may seem like IAC is harder to pronounce, but it explains then the streamlined Athabaskan, if that's intelligible, and provides a whole different look at the origin of Athabaskan from a different angle, quite literally, and as explained by the window analogy. It's historically important that way, and I would say that although it might appeal only to a linguist or a weirdo specialist like myself, I beg to disagree. In fact, I've seldom met any thoughtful Alaskan natives who don't readily understand why IAC is important, even for that, and important to every Athabaskan as their only cousin, when they've got brothers and sisters galore, that they can see the importance of it, and they can see also the social importance, because, okay, there's a parade of languages that are going to disappear. maybe all Alaskan languages, and Eyak is merely number one. And who's next? Who's the next volunteer? And that issue of who's going to be next? Who wants to be next? Does anybody want to be next? Is important to all Native Alaskans, and I dare say important to Alaskans too, because it's McDonald's or Tio Taco is not very different from ones in Arizona, but languages are. Mm-hmm. And the what is uniquely Alaskan is, and that has been tragically not neglected so much as actually suppressed continually in the school. No child left behind. Everybody ends up same place. No time for Eyak. No time for diversity. No time for still knowing how to live on St. Lawrence Island. Not when you've got to learn the right basketball cheers in English. And all heading in the same place. And so Eyak will be the first of the children not left behind. And all the rest are to follow in what order? And what does Alaska care? So there's a certain lesson in Eyak. What we're losing, and I give you an example, not only the nature of the Eyak language, but the Eyak's take on the human condition, different from perforce from everybody else's. We're just losing another voice, and I like to hope at least that what I've done maybe in some ways can palliate or compensate for that. And hope that all the rest soon to follow can be maybe exempted from the parade in some way or other if Alaska Native Language Center is allowed to survive. There's nobody else doing it. That's for damn sure. Which could bring me to the subject of the relationship, if any, between Alaska Native Language and Center and the Anthropology Department.
Do you want to speak about that since you came here? In which case you would have to speak about Ivar Skarland.
Yeah, well, Ivar Skarland is the main culprit in the whole thing.
Okay.
He was a nice man and a clever guy, and always nice to me in certain ways. He was respectful, but it was always clear that he had no interest or expertise in the field of language, and his concept of the Anthro Department did not include language, but primarily from the heritage of the early days, archaeology and physical anthropology. So he looked even at living specimens of Alaska natives as skeletons, even if they were still walking around. And it is said that he didn't even need his calipers or something, but just by the look of the cephalic indices of somebody just looking, you know, the top of the head or maybe even from the side, could tell whether they came from this or that racial strain, subracial substrain of cephalic types walking around Alaska. And I'm sure he was very remarkable in this, but it definitely did not follow the Boasian definition of linguistics that included really even cultural anthropology along with physical and archaeology, let alone linguistics, which is totally out, and social anthropology was nowhere nearly as important or strong as archaeology. And this goes back to the very beginnings of the discipline, if you want to call it that, in the way it was practiced by the guy who started it all, Otto Geist, who was working for the mining companies and unearthing mammoth tusks and maybe some skulls or arrowheads along with it, and became a kind of archaeological junk collector or something. But it was obvious that Alaska was a treasure trove of this kind of thing. And there was a long period in there from about 1929 to probably 1949, during which archaeological anthropology and physical anthropology were the University of Alaska's one and only respectable research agenda. It's made very clear by Wickersham, even though he was no friend to Bunnell, who was a friend to Otto Geist. Bunnell set a certain patterns here of quasi-scholarship, but not real, and I don't know if this place has ever recovered, ever grown past it. The Geist legacy, which is kind of shameful, nevertheless, the pride of this place, which otherwise was nothing but a claim that civilization could be brought to this godforsaken wilderness, empty of anything that could be called civilization, until a white man came along and built Greek temples on Chena River, the Masonic Lodge, and so on, proving that civilization, the only kind there is, will triumph even here. Although it's, emphasize even here, because we're uncomfortably close to Siberia. That is, Siberia in the positive Russian sense, where good thinkers, original thinkers, that is political dissidents, were exiled by the Tsars and later by the Bolsheviks to the Gulag, because there was some honor in that. But in the American sense of Siberia, meaning by definition incompetence and second or third rate anything. And the university is still here to prove that Western civilization can triumph over even Tanana Valley. That therefore, although it's a gentlemanly thing to do, and sort of key to that kind of gentlemanly respectability that we have the time and the money to use for impractical pursuits like collecting curios of disappearing cultures around us and bones and stones and making scientific study of that and writing papers about it and so on, which is still key to the anthro department's priorities, is so-called academic respectability, because of the, for a long time anthropology was the most respectable academic thing. Everything else was a second rate or third rate or Siberia rate claim that civilization can triumph even in the Tanana Valley. But the gentlemanly pursuit of collecting bones and stones, on the other hand, is proof of true civilization. Okay. And basic anthropology department may be allowing for some folklore or kinship terms, but mainly, okay, the clever way that people started fires or chipped stones or treated their uncles or something could be also written about beside bones and stones. But when it came to language, forget it. And that's the way it was when I got here. The languages were still being actively suppressed in the school system. The education department of the university trained people to do that, trained people who did that, never did anything that had anything to do with support of anything in a native language or anything to do with a native language in a positive way, but it was a part of triumphing educational system, converting people into good civilized, that is, necktie-wearing and Christian civilized people, and who did not speak an unintelligible gibberish, and which is much more threatening than wearing feathers in your head. Anybody can see what you're doing there, but if you're speaking an unintelligible gibberish, you could be plotting anything.
So none of Scarland or Geist did not speak any native language?
Oh my God! They never paid any attention to them. But they were part of a system, university which was totally in agreement that these languages should disappear, although it would be gentlemanly if someone collected the curios.
Right, okay.
But they didn't bother collecting linguistic curios, even that. And so along we came, and you've got that story. And then that, if it was ever, it's an unanswerable question, would the anthropology department ever have started to include linguistics if we hadn't come along? To this day, possibly not. Maybe probably not. But since we came along, well, that answered the question. ANLC is doing it. Krauss was doing it in the 60s and his grants, not the university, but Krauss and his grants. And then by 1972, Krauss and the Native Language Center, paid for by the legislature, is true, but which, of course, at the same time was its Achilles heel, because that gave the university an access to the money to deploy for other things, which it has consistently been doing ever since.
Yeah, but your question, if the department would do that if it didn't come alone, seems can become a little bit general. If anyone would do it, if you didn't.
Well, put it this way: that it's probable that other universities elsewhere would have sent people here, as they did, for example, on rare occasions. It is true, but and there were missionaries. That's a whole other story. Like Li Fanghui, 1952, that other entities would have sent people to Alaska occasionally to do this and that. That Alaska, can the University of Alaska even afford to be too Alaskan? Can it be afford? I mean, we're close enough to Siberia as it is. I mean, both literally and worse, figuratively, to be then waving it all around, holding it up and waving it around, say, hey, we're in Siberia, that was left to me. And I dare say that what we do is, with this emphasis on Alaskan, languages, not Choctaw or something, not general. We don't care about making sure that everybody who works here has a general degree in linguistics and has done give a course in African languages every 7 years, but it's Alaska. We're here to serve Alaska and work on Alaskan languages, and that's like saying, hey, we're in Siberia. And I sort of almost made an art of wallowing, I don't know if you know that verb, a pig wallows in mud, to roll around sensuously enjoying the mud. And here we were, you know, wallowing around in the snow of Siberia, say, hey, we're in Siberia, this is an interesting place, and so on. There's a certain provincialism complex about this place that, you know, if it's to Alaska and it's Siberia, and not academically respectable, except that a lot of the university lip service is paid to it in the so-called mission statements of the university, but no real support. It's purely hypocritical because, well, I don't even understand it, because hell, I came here as a volunteer to Siberia, not because I, you know, had no other prospects, and the basic. As such, I've never fit in too well here, and never been felt all that well. Yeah, there's a lot, often nice things are said about what we're doing here, and the university professes some pride, but it's purely for other purposes, because it's never shown any real support. And the Anthro department is unrelated because it does not consider linguistics part of its, except maybe, well, it inherited those two ladies, wasn't looking to include linguistics, and their position is problematical. But they have never had anything to do with documenting Alaskan languages. And there's a certain irony to that. So the department can always claim, well, we've got the Alaska Native Language Center, so why should we duplicate what they're doing? I claim that there should be a lot more cooperation or work between the two, but I would say it was just beginning when we were then sequestered, segregated away into Brooks Building, right. Very deliberately, and
from Mileson.
From Mileson, yeah. Right. It was going to be, I think, going to improve, but it can't now.
So, what's that story with the segregation?
Well, they thought that the University of Alaska Fairbanks should have a more visible native authority, and including a building devoted to native something or other. And we were not consulted in any of this, or consulted in our fate at all. In fact, we were very deliberately excluded from any information or voice in what was going to, as to the physical disposition of the center, or I don't want to get into all of this, because I am more interested in a way in the anthro side of it, and the history of that too, which had little signs of things happening, but it never took place, and the strange career of Charlene Kraft, for example, which needs to be, someone should look into. Here's a woman from Cordova itself who never had anything to do with EAC when something could have been done. Hmm. And in the anthropology department. And probably too late to ask anybody still alive, but the department should ask itself, you know, what is its relevance to Alaska Natives other than as subjects of study?
Right. So did you have any discussions with Scarlett and others, and Kraft maybe, about...
I never overlapped with Kraft.
Right.
But with Skyland, no. I talked to Skyland a lot about, but on a purely academic basis, not on a policy basis as to what anthropology should be doing. No. Mm-hmm. That was written in stone. It still is.
So you think when you left, when the NLC went to the Brooks Building, you weren't advised or anything like that, addressed, but was the anthropology department?
No, you managed to stay out of it.
So you regarded it as a negative move instead of a positive move?
What? To
move?
Of course.
And why?
In part because we were not being consulted.
Yeah.
And in part because the reason for doing so was negative, that they wanted to use us as a kind of ballast to justify the use of the building, while knowing they were going to cut our space by
right.
a very significant amount, but they didn't want us to be involved, or we would, and so on. And our relationship with the people, any of the other people in the building, is zero or negative. And they never welcomed us either. And they always criticized us as being too snooty and removed from Native students. And now we see no Native students. Some of our very people we work with most closely refuse to enter the fourth floor. There's a very uncomfortable situation, but that was predictable. I knew it. I would have, had I not been circumvented and left entirely, systematically excluded from all the conferences that were going on about us and how to use us, that they knew I would have objected to, hence the exclusion.
What floor were you in Nielsen?
The floor right below yours. We were right beneath you on the second floor.
And the museum, what date was that when you moved?
Blocked that out of my mind. It's like 3 years ago.
Ah, right.
Or 2 years ago.
Oh, okay. So soon. Right.
2 years.
Right. So, I mean, of all the anthropology faculty which you met, there was no one who gave any more than the gentleman interest to you about language? Not even students, if you had any relationship?
Rarely. Students even were, who went to the anthropology department, were kept studiously there, never allowed to take any of our courses.
Right.
Our courses have been basically boycotted by, my courses always completely boycotted by anthropology. No anthro major for at least 20 years ever took a course from me.
Right.
Even those that purportedly came here because of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not exaggerating. All of anthro's required courses are anthro, and they don't require any, or even allow for degree courses in any other department that I know of. Maybe they do English or something, but certainly not Alaska Native language. And my courses were always totally boycotted by anthropology, and whether UPIC students are encouraged to take UPIC by anthropology, I rather doubt, but maybe, I don't know enough about that. But anthro's own departmental requirements are, I think, maybe exclusively, certainly anthro, or but certainly include no Alaska Native anything. So you can get a degree in any kind of anthropology without a single course in language, a native language.